This Week in Retronauts, it's a retirement party. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Retronauts Micro. That's right, Micro. This is a mini episode, even though it's kind of structured like a real episode. I am Jeremy Parrish, and with me this week to celebrate retirement is...
Chris Kohler, features editor of Kotaku.
Ooh, that sounds weird.
That is
You've never
new.
Done that before.
I know, that's really wow. weird.
Still getting used to that, huh?
Yep.
All right, you?
Jose Otero, editor at IGN.
Okay, that's the same.
Uh-huh. Hey, I'm retiring.
I'm Bob Takeda on me, Mackie.
What?
Take
oh,
on
wow. Oh, my goodness.
There we go.
You were holding this.
I was writing that in the bathroom, so you're welcome.
That was what you were doing. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Brainstorming.
Yes. So Bob gave away the big surprise.
Hey, it's in the title of the episode. People know.
But sometimes people just like click blindly on iTunes.
I
just
going to
download
yeah,
a thing.
I do. I'm just like, audio, give me.
What is
Let's
old
go.
Old video games. Forget that. Yes, this week we are talking about Genyo Takeda, who is a Nintendo executive and game designer who has been in the industry for a long time, but no more. He recently announced at an investors meeting, I believe,
mm-hmm.
that
Which makes
he,
sense.
Yes, he is retiring, and it's kind of a big deal. He's been
it
there
is.
Forever.
Yep.
Is he like the most tenured person at Nintendo now?
He's up there.
Is yeah, he the maybe. Most tenured person in the video
I
games
think,
industry now?
Oh, my goodness.
only if Gunpei Yokoi had still been at Nintendo and not died would he be the – he would beat Takeda, I think. Was Gen,
he came in under under Yokoi.
Yeah.
And yeah, if Hiroshi Yamauchi hadn't died, he'd also be
right.
more tenured.
But I mean like game
sure.
designers, yeah. not
But I mean,
money
Yamauchi left and you know, I mean, Gunpei Yokoi actually did – he did not go out of Nintendo in a, you know, pine box. He quit.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, yeah,
right.
yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
possibly, and if not, don't at me.
Yeah. No, I'm curious to know. Is there someone who has been at Nintendo longer
some
than Takeda?
80-year-old accountant who won't go home.
Well, again, I tell this story a lot, but the first, you know, back in the year 2002 when I waltzed in like a big dumb foreigner right into Nintendo's old playing cards building, there was a little old man in the lobby of the playing cards building that yelled at me to get out. And that dude, he might have been working at Nintendo for a long time.
Yeah, so he might still be there.
Yeah, but this is custom, right? Like you're a member of the board of directors, you have to sort of say, okay, I'm retiring and here's my replacement, which they said was the guy under him, Ko Shioda. Shioda, I may be mispronouncing mm-hmm. that, but that's sort of his partner in arms at Nintendo.
Okay. So why is it a big deal that Genyo Takeda is retiring? Why are we having an episode about a guy retiring?
Star Tropics. I mean, come on. Nintendo's best game.
Punch Out. We're getting warmer.
Well, I think it's just the fact that who else has been in the games industry as mm-hmm. long as Genyo Takeda? And he's had his hands on a lot of really big projects, but also, you know, because he has risen in the ranks at Nintendo, he's just been a key figure in one of the biggest games company for
True.
As long as the games industry has existed. 45 yep. years. He came to Nintendo in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
That is a long time. So I just feel like this is pretty remarkable and probably deserves to be remarked upon.
For sure.
So
let us remark.
Yes. Chris, have you ever interviewed Takeda?
No. And now that he finally left Nintendo, maybe one day I'll get the chance.
Yeah. When did he stop working in actual game design? It's been a while, right?
You're holding the notes.
I want to say he helped maybe – God, I want to say Super Punch-Out, maybe he like oversaw that with his protege, the guy who directed Punch-Out for NES. But he could have been just on some random Wii channel thing or something like that. I mean, I know he directed the first official video game that Nintendo ever made, like for first arcade game, I think.
Yeah, yes, first mechanical EDR game. Race. Yeah. Yeah, it was a mechanical game, right, that was like very you know, just in Nintendo's practices, just like not the most efficient piece of technology, I would say. Like it kept breaking down and needed a lot of servicing. It was based on like a weird use of technology and video imaging.
Yeah, and I cracked the books on Takeda for the Punch-Out episode.
That's
and
right.
It was
you
like,
should listen to that, kids.
Oh, thank you. That's where Punch-Out came from because the video thing was too unreliable. So they're like, let's pretend it's video. And that's sort of how it came into being. But this is Jeremy's episode, so sorry.
No, that's fine. Flesh this out. I didn't like – you know, put down a lot of
I was afraid to say these things.
This. No, okay. Go ahead. I mean, I would like for this to be more kind of like an organic conversation.
I mean, I've said all these things on the Punch-Out episode. That was like 8 months ago. But yeah, EVR Race was Nintendo's first arcade game. It was a video-based game using an obsolete now obsolete format in which you place bets on either cars or horses
on two flavors.
The model or whatever. And it would switch to different video tracks, so it would be randomized. And I don't know if you would actually win money or if it was just you were just choosing for fun. I've seen a picture of the unit, but I don't know actually how it functions.
Yeah, it was based around kind of a similar like technological premise to Wild Gunman, right?
I think the original
projection system that would change to different video tracks depending on whether you shot a dude or he shot you.
I don't know the technological basis for Wild Gunman, but I'm guessing it could be that EVR format, which was used briefly and never used again.
And if you want to see this thing, like Google it, but it'll show up on beforemario.com. Like they have a bunch of like photos of it. It accommodated – EVR Race accommodated 1 to 10 players, which was insane, although the picture they had on the site I think was only 5. But there's just fun facts like that you should totally check out.
Yeah. But he kind of came up pretty quickly through the ranks, I think. And I mean, you know, like a decade after he joined Nintendo, he was running his own division. And I know we've talked about this, but basically once Nintendo started getting into video games and you know, launched their home console, the Famicom, they kind of restructured internally and created divisions. So there were like basically 4 R&D divisions. I think there was always R&D 1, but then, you know, R&D 2 came along and then R&D 3. And then after Donkey Kong, Shigeru Miyamoto was given a new division, R&D 4, which eventually became Entertainment Analysis Division, EAD, which
now is
Entertainment
EAD.
Analysis and Development.
Development, that's it.
That's right. Yeah. Which now has a different name again because they've restructured.
They merged everything.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, they re kind of compiled their internal structure in 2002 or so.
Yeah.
But you know, kind of during the classic era, the NES era, the Super NES era, they worked with these divisions, and you know, R&D 1 was like Game Boy and portable systems. R&D 2 was the – we don't really talk about R&D 2.
What was R&D 2?
Was R&D 2 his division?
No. He worked Uemura, the guy who created – designed the Famicom.
That's right.
Was R&D 2's head.
Okay.
And then Takeda was put in charge of R&D 3.
What did EAD become? R&D 4 was EAD, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, like EAD was R&D4's name later.
And for our listeners, EAD, Mario and Zelda teams basically, right?
Yeah.
For the most part.
Basically, it kind of sounds like once a person kind of, you know, proved themselves and became super instrumental in Nintendo's success, they were given their own division. Because you started with Yokoi in R&D1, and he was like the old guard guy who put Nintendo on the map in the first place, with Ultra Hand. And then Uemura came over from, I want to say, Sharp, and helped design the TV consoles that Nintendo launched in 1975. Mm-hmm. Then Takeda was put in charge of R&D 3 after, you know, kind of proving his merit with arcade games and stuff. And then Miyamoto was given R&D 4 once Donkey Kong exploded. So
R&D 2, which I just looked up, this was Uemura's division. Mm-hmm. And this was really more focused on not only like technology, but like system operating software and technical support, says Wikipedia. So their list of games, which exists, is very short.
Pretty small,
they did Mach Rider and Ice Hockey. And then it's like they did like – They did Sute Hakun, mm-hmm. and then they did all the porting for the Mario Advance games on Game Boy Advance. It's just a very, very small list.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They did the Mario games.
Yeah.
And now that group has become kind of its own group at Nintendo. It was
merged into Nintendo SPD, which was merged into EAD, and I still forget. Is it called EP? What is the new? What is
EPD,
the
EPD? Is it EPD? I think so. Yeah, it's EPD. Yeah. I used to put an extra E on it, but yeah, it's don't know what the acronym said. Yeah,
oh, God, I forgot.
I really missed the pre 2003 Nintendo divisions. I knew them and I knew what they made. Now it's just like
now the point is they finally eliminated the last vestige of Yamauchi's basically like feudal lord system in which all the divisions competed with each other and didn't know what the other divisions were doing and kept technological secrets from each other.
Wow.
And so Nintendo has finally cut all that out, and now there's one hardware development group. Because again, like the portable and the home systems
were separate,
developed by different groups. So they finally eliminated one hardware group, one software group, the end.
Right.
Yeah.
Takeda kind of rose to prominence within this feudal structure and became R&D3's daimyo, more or less.
Yeah, precisely.
So, R&D3 was more software focused than R&D2. Maybe not as quite as R&D or as software focused as, you know, R&D4. Like, I don't think Miyamoto's division ever worked on anything that wasn't just software. Like, that was what they did.
They did not, as a general rule, no, they did not do hardware.
Whereas Takeda's group was kind of mostly focused on software, but sometimes they came up with things that helped make their software better. And that ended up being really instrumental in the success of the NES and really shaped kind of the direction that hardware took outside the US or outside of Japan, where Nintendo had a much tighter leash on software development and especially on licensees. Takeda's group came up with the memory mapper chip scheme, which basically made NES games capable of being interesting and functional and worth playing after 1986 or so, when, you know, the hard limits of the basic NES cartridge capabilities and the basic hardware capabilities of the system itself were sort of, you know, hit the wall.
Hmm. Yeah, and other things he developed, I pulled up my punch-out notes as a refresher. I have down here the backup battery, the analog controller on the N64, and he was a key developer of the Wii, which we talked about in our Wii episode.
Yeah, that backup battery was like so important for Zelda, right? Like, could we have gotten Zelda without it?
It would have been a password system, and it would have been terrible.
Yeah, important for game design in general.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Like being able to save your progress without a password.
That Japan experienced Zelda, and there were load times. You had to like flip over the disc.
It's not that bad, though. It's really not that bad.
Yeah.
I've played all the way through it on Famicom Disk System, and it's not that bad.
It's not as fast though.
It's not like Simon's Quest, where if you go left from the first town, you have to flip the disk, or you don't flip the disk, but you have to load.
Yeah.
And then it, like, you know, there's those two werewolves who come at you in the swamp immediately to the left of the first town.
That's right.
And if you get hit by the werewolves who fire projectiles at you as soon as you show up on screen, you'll get hit and fly back off screen into town, and then there's another like 10-second load time. So that's bad. Zelda's not that bad.
Okay,
But the battery backup allowed people to plug in their cartridge, press it down, press the power button, and it jumped in, press start. There's a title screen, a save select screen. You press start again, and you're playing, as opposed to doing all that and then punching in a 64-digit password with ambiguous characters and upper and lowercase letters and
who can forget
numbers.
Metroid and the awful font that was chosen.
Wasn't even that bad. I mean, that was a fairly compact
You still got it wrong from time to time.
You did.
Though. It hurt.
But I was thinking more like Fezzanadu or something where it's just like that font was bad.
All the serifs.
Passwords were like, they were like so long.
Didn't every letter have like 9 serifs on it? So like, what am I even looking at here?
Yes, basically. So, you know, people still used passwords because it was cheaper to incorporate a password into your game than to incorporate SRAM and a battery. But, you know, for Nintendo first party games, it made a lot of sense because they were the ones, you know, holding the purse strings. That was their own manufacturing process. So they were kind of like, yeah, let's just put a battery in here. And it made their games just like you can just jump right in and play. And, you know, with mm-hmm. Zelda, that meant, you know, no matter how long you played, no matter how far into the game you'd gotten, you could always just save the game when you were done. You died. Okay. You hit save. You're frustrated and disgusted with the game. You don't want to write down a password. You're depressed because you lost at the seventh dungeon again. So, yeah, it just made the games more playable, more approachable.
You also said the analog stick, right?
For the N64, yeah.
Yeah, no, there's another really important piece of technology. I mean, I feel – although, I mean, was there anything like it before that?
There have been analog controllers, sure.
Yeah. But, yeah.
And you know, the battery backup had been used in pinball machines to save high scores, right? So, I mean, it's not like they came out of whole cloth. But
no,
it's like
but I mean
the idea of let's apply this. I mean, no, I mean it's like, no
let's,
less
let's
impressive
put that into
to say
a cartridge. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. To say let's put this in every video game cartridge we sell. I mean, that's you know that's a smart
yeah.
smart thing.
Well,
to
that's
do.
Kind of the theme of his career. I mean, even being involved heavily in like the Wii, for example, which was sure. like Nintendo's moment of hey, we're not going to follow where technology's going. Instead, we're going to work on power consumption, make it smaller, make it more efficient, and we're not going to blow the doors off with graphics mm-hmm. like
yeah,
everyone
was,
else is going for.
That's the same thing with Punch-Out. Right. It's like we could make a Laserdisc game, but we'll make a much cheaper version that we don't have to maintain that will have the same effect on people. It's just these cheaper solutions, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
never in my life, by the way, have I seen a Punch-Out machine in Japan. I mean,
wow.
A lot of this is like you don't actually see a lot of old Japanese arcade machines in Japan period, just because, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of room in Japan,
right.
So they tend to get rid of a lot of this
yeah.
stuff. But, I mean, I really have never, ever seen a Punch-Out in Japan. I'm not saying they didn't release it there. They did. But, like, just never saw
NCL's
one.
NCL's hanging on to all of them. Like, everyone else, too bad.
Well, most of what you see in Japan now are
– they're the standardized,
yeah,
know,
most of what you see in Japan now are
– Astro City, whatever, right. You know, sit-down cabinets. Yeah, and they put games that would go into those cabinets and they put them in those cabinets. Punch-Out, since it requires the dual monitor setup, doesn't slot easily into, you know, any existing cabinets.
yeah, but even Punch-Out and that dual monitor setup, just the problem to solve being, hey, we have too many monitors left over.
Let's do something.
Please use these for something, anything.
Yep. Very smart.
Yeah.
But yeah, the
Nintendo way.
That is the Nintendo way.
It's interesting that, you know, you talked earlier, Chris, about the feudal lord system and how there was a left-hand, right-hand failure to communicate within Nintendo's divisions. But I do think it's interesting that a lot of what Takeda did during the NES era was to make someone else's hardware design more viable.
Mm. Sure.
I mean, besides the battery backup, again, you had the MMC, the memory mapper chips, and those were essential to making the Famicom and NES viable beyond kind of like their basic hardware level because they allowed basically a paging system where you could – it was kind of like putting multiple game ROMs together.
Mm.
The NES could only look at so much at a time. But, you know, this much of a game, like, you know, is a very small amount. You can have Super Mario Brothers in there if you really squeeze. But anything more complex than that – there's just no room, but the memory mapper chips allowed you to have like a page that was the size of Super Mario Brothers, and then you flip the page and there's another game code chunk the size of Super Mario Brothers, and so you just keep adding those and it switches over.
Hmm.
And all of a sudden, you know, instead of having a one-page book, you've got a novel basically.
Yeah, I must have made those programmers really happy. I'll say that.
I'm sure it did. I mean, I think, you know, the Famicom disk system was designed to sort of address that problem to give people more capacity. But then they came up with a memory mapper chip scheme, and all of a sudden the Famicom disk system wasn't really necessary, and it was also really easy to pirate.
Yeah, so, and the disks had a limited capacity, so it was larger, but as soon as cartridges passed that, right. the disk was behind and they couldn't do anything to the disks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So people were like, why didn't the disk system ever come to the US? Well, that's because by the time it would have made sense to bring it over, mm-hmm. it didn't make sense
They'd already
anymore.
Moved on, yeah. yeah.
Like cartridges were better, and yep. that's because of the memory mapper system, the scheme.
It's funny that you talk about these groups working in isolation. That's it explains Star Tropics to me perfectly. It's like this team is making their own Zelda but with an arcade sensibility. It's not the Zelda sensibility. So it is a Zelda-ish game, but it's like really punishing and requires like really good reflexes. And I hate it, but I want to love it so much. There's so much about that game I want to love. But
yeah.
it's one of the like two or three games he's directed, maybe four games he's directed.
He's directed four games,
yeah,
as far
like
as I can tell.
Two arcade Punch-Out games, Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, and Star Tropics.
Mm. Oh, also pro wrestling.
Oh, pro wrestling?
He worked on that. I think that was kind of a collaborative venture with a company called Try, which eventually became Human Entertainment.
Okay, cool. Yeah. But I feel like he was always rooted in the arcade that arcade world with his game design, so I can definitely see that with Star Tropics mm-hmm. for sure. And God, I love that game, but I also hate it.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting that – I mean one of the reasons I wanted to talk about Takeda is because his games have – more than anyone who I think has ever worked at Nintendo internally, his games have the most sort of like Western mentality, the Western mm-hmm. appeal.
I'm guessing what happened was something along the lines of – Nintendo of America is like, hey, this game will do really well for us in the West. Can we get a game like this? And Nintendo's like, well, Miyamoto's not going to make it, and the other game development division under Yokoi, they're not going to make it. So we're going to give it to R&D 3, and they'll make your game.
Yokoi
for you
likes making things that are Japanese weird, but we want Western weird. So let's give it to Takeda.
Right. Yeah, I mean, basically, like they were just like, okay, yeah, you guys do it. I mean, I'm kind of like, this is my headcanon, but there's probably a reason for that. Everybody else is probably just busy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but kind of one of the weird side effects or interesting side effects is that I think because you know this group did come up with all the memory mapper chips, like some of their games use memory mapper schemes that no other games on NES ever did.
Yeah,
Punch-Out uses a unique chip. It's only used in Punch-Out and Mike Tyson's Punch-Out called the MMC-2, mm-hmm. which allows like I think more and bigger sprites or something like that.
Right.
I can't remember exactly.
Were they big?
That was essentially like they couldn't bring Punch-Out the arcade game over to the NES as is, but I think they looked at it and they said, okay, well, what can we have and what can we lose? Do we need a big Little Mac, you know, character on screen with wireframes? No, it's really not necessary. Do we need a two-monitor thing? No. Do we need big, expressive boxer mm-hmm. characters? Yes. And so it was like we need to do that. So if that means it have to have – and maybe they envisioned this chip being used later on down the line.
Yeah.
But again, maybe like the disk system, it was just supplanted technologically very quickly and it was like, oh, there's no reason to ever use this again.
Yeah. I mean they came up with the MMC-3, mm-hmm. which allowed for, you know like the score boxes along the screens and like two-directional scrolling and things like that. So all of a sudden, yeah, like the MMC-2 – did some cool stuff, but the MMC-3 was, you know, the next step and it was much more practical for what people wanted to do with their game.
And it was a generalist sort of thing versus something mm-hmm. that's like, it gives you big sprites. It's like, okay, well, unless you're going to make a game that has like, you know, giant towering characters, you don't really need this.
You mentioned Little Mac and he only exists in the NES version. He's not in the SNES version
Correct.
Or the arcade games, but he's Little Mac because they couldn't make him big.
Right.
So they made him Little Mac. And I think that's so ingenious. It's like, oh, he's a little guy. So there you go. That's your explanation.
Well,
that's
like Mario before the mushroom.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, that's the Nintendo way of design the game first and then write the story later based on what you had to – what your design restraints were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the other unique mapper chip that Takeda's games used was the MMC-6, which was actually just the MMC-3 plus battery backup. And it wasn't until I started reading about this, you know, this unique chip that – you know, apparently is a little harder to emulate than the standard MMC-3. I was like, well, wait a minute. You couldn't save games on MMC-3s? And I started looking and no MMC-3 game has battery backup. If a game has battery backup, it's MMC-4, which I realize this is like super, you know, minutiae, like
right.
who really cares? But this it is interesting because like these mapper technologies played a big part in kind of the design and capabilities and potential of NES games. And, you know, MFC3 was by far the most popular of the later NES cartridges. Like everything, Super Mario Brothers 3, et cetera, were on MFC3. And I think, you know, maybe Super Mario Brothers 3 didn't have battery backup because the chip didn't exist for it.
Yeah,
until
and
later.
It's like, it's funny because if you, the more you start to learn about this stuff, the more you can start to figure out, okay, well, why was this game designed the way it was? Oh, it was literally because of the cost of parts, the availability yeah. of what using this part meant for, you know, you can't have a saved game, you know. So, yeah, it's really, and it's fascinating.
MMC6 was only used in the Star Tropics games, just those
right.
games.
Those oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
They're the only games of those style that
again,
can actually use
you know,
battery backup.
He had the direct line to Yamauchi, so literally all they had to do was get him drunk enough to say, okay, you can make a chip and use it on your only your own games. like it's in, and it's – you know, I don't know if they would – I would go so far as to say, oh, and then he never shared it with anybody else. He wanted to keep it to
that.
Himself. I see, I would doubt that. But to be able to make essentially to say a bespoke chip for these games, especially if the order is coming down from America saying, hey, you know, again, we really think Punch-Out will be a world-smashing success in America, and it was. Or we need a game like Star Tropics that's something that's geared towards the American style of
yeah,
play.
Yeah, I mean, Star Tropics never was released in Japan, nor was its sequel.
No.
So those games must have done – the first game must have done well enough here that they were, you know, justified in creating a sequel to it several years later. They were yeah. like, yeah, that was a hit. Let's make another one.
In
yeah.
terms of the ideas, like, why, like, did he share these ideas or did he keep them to himself? Like, he was working on Star Tropics while everyone else was working on Super Famicom stuff. So it's like, we don't need these chips. We're not going to make any more NES games.
Right.
Like, just
right,
do whatever
right.
you want.
So would you then say he was always at the tail end for a bit at Nintendo? Like, just just behind in
and
terms
I, well,
of
I,
what the
I,
new
I
thing
think
was?
It, well, at this point, nope, there had never been a generational shift like this, and nobody really knew. Like the NES was so popular and made so much money in foreign territories. Nobody really knew like the 8-bit business. Like, is it just going to keep going? You know, are we going to shift over into 16-bit smoothly? Is 16 and 8-bit going to sit on the shelves together? Like, what are we going to do? So you did see Nintendo putting in a lot of resources into continuing to develop 8-bit games, even as a Super Famicom was coming out, because there was no sense of this generational shift where, okay, we're going to wind this down, we're going to wind this up, and nobody really knew what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, 8-bit crashed and burned really fast.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, I think if you look in kind of the wider spectrum, the most successful 8-bit systems lasted like 10 years. I mean, NES, Famicom, that was around for 11 years. The Spectrum in the UK was around forever
and
ever.
Well, the market fell out really quickly.
Yeah. But I don't think it was an immediate collapse. I think it was kind of a transition.
There was, if you look at you know, like business type magazines and things like that at the time, there was definitely a sense that people expected 8-bit to be strong for longer than it was.
Yeah. I think they were hedging their bets, but also I think it was basically all hands on deck. Like, we finished Mario 3. Now we make Mario World and Zelda Link to the Past. Like,
yeah.
all of our top guys are doing this for the next like 3 years. So,
right.
like, we're not going to see very much out of Nintendo itself outside of things like Takeda's division.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Makes you hope that's the story today with 3DS and Switch, but I digress.
It seems very much like R&D3 was I don't know what the metaphor is here, batting cleanup. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, they were just like engaged to deliver the things that were necessary that other people weren't doing. They were team players.
Yeah. It's like the team that's, you know, working on Hey Pikmin now. Like, it's not glorious, but kids are going to buy it. It's going to make money for the company. So you got to suck it up and do it.
Someone's got to employ R-Zest. Not me.
R-Zest. Okay. So anyway, is there anything else really to be said about Takeda? Like, I feel
well,
like we kind
I mean,
of talked about the most essential things here. But
so his last position on the passing away of Satoru Iwata, when Nintendo sort of were like, what are we going to do for leadership here? I mean, he was one of the two members of Nintendo that was elevated to the position of fellow, Miyamoto being creative fellow and Takeda being technology fellow
right.
to advise President Kimishima.
And acting director for a little bit, right? Didn't he and Miyamoto share that role?
They had that triad kind of thing going on.
Yeah,
but Kimishima
yeah,
was
shortly.
Also
yeah.
there doing that stuff as, mm-hmm. as well. Right?
Sure.
Yeah.
I just hope we get a thorough hours-long interview with him, because more than even Miyamoto, more than Tezuka, more than anyone, could he tell you about the history of Nintendo. Like,
I mean, he saw the company's transformation firsthand. He was there in the
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I hope he talks and talks and talks. So we'll see.
Yeah, and he's, if anything, like, I mean, we did mention heavily influenced by Yokoi to the point that, like, followed the same philosophy, the same virtues of, like, hey, it's the application of the technology and not being on the bleeding edge of everything, mm-hmm. right? And to an extent, that lives on in Switch. That is very much still the case.
I mean, Wii was the first Nintendo home console to adopt the Gunpei Yokoi, you know, season technology concept.
But the
that was always
forever.
Built into the handhelds. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like the Wii was the first time that appeared in a home console, and they said, you know what? Let's not compete with Sony, you know, blow to blow. Let's just do our own thing. And that was Takeda coming in, and you know, he had a big part in shaping that direction and saying, like, we don't have to go HD yet. We don't have to have the most technologically impressive system. We can do something that's going to be different and appealing, and it'll be a success anyway. And they're right.
Yeah, and it impacted everything, right? I mean, it impacted the hardware sales for sure. It impacted the way the company was making games. I mean, they were trying very much to re-explain games to people because they got a whole new audience in there that they didn't expect and know necessarily how to talk to. Talk to us. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hopefully they will talk to us. Hopefully Takeda will talk to us and we'll learn lots of cool little tidbits about Nintendo now that he's no longer under corporate lock and key. Or
and I mean, it, you know, it, geez, like it's just nice. I'm trying to phrase this in the right way. It's nice to see people retire from Nintendo like before they're, I don't know, 80 years old. Because like as much as I like Nintendo, as much as I think Shigeru Miyamoto makes some pretty neat video games. The board of Nintendo right now, the youngest person on that board, I believe, is 44 years old. Whew. And the rest of it, you have this – I mean, and they – you know, anybody you talk to will tell you, oh, yeah, like, you know, anything Nintendo does, you got to get it past this board of directors. And they are some old men. Like,
yes.
Miyamoto is a sprightly young 63. Like on that board. So I mean, to see people saying, you know what, I think I'll retire instead of staying here until I am dust.
Yeah. Takeda's only 68. So he made it out in his 60s.
He did. And so maybe get some new young blood in there. Maybe a guy who's just in his 50s or something. Maybe somebody who just had his first grandkid can get in there and start literally making decisions as to like what Nintendo is gonna do with the video game.
I mean,
market.
We've seen what young teams can do at Nintendo, like Splatoon, like that is their invention and they trust them
that
and they made it hit.
Like the leader on that team though is not that young though, isn't he?
Right,
But he's young. They call it like the young leader.
But it's not
young
it's
leader,
less about like we made a video game and more about like, you know, the making of big moves, you know, within the video game industry and like striking while the iron is hot and doing what's going to, you know, be
well, that's
successful.
A completely separate issue. Striking while the iron is hot definitely seems to evade Nintendo constantly. But I do think that Switch is part of that too, right? That transition.
Yep.
Younger people involved. Even for 1-2 Switch and all of its weirdness, like that was not made by old men. It was made by a younger guard. So hopefully we'll continue to see
you
that.
You need to make – it's like you – to be successful, it's like you need to make the radical changes before you have a huge bottoming out failure. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it's tough to convince a company like Nintendo to – it's like you can get them to make radical change after they've like thoroughly face planted and everybody goes, okay, old ways aren't working. What's the new way? But it's like they couldn't have done the Switch coming off of the Wii.
The Wii U
was this extremely conservative thing that just did not. Yeah, exactly. So again.
But what a library it had.
New blood in there, hopefully.
All right. Well, I don't want to belabor the point. This is a quick and efficient, tidy little episode. But I did want to sort of pay tribute to one of gaming's most enduring and I think in a lot of ways important designers.
That's
and I am looking forward to seeing someone who can step into Takeda's shoes. But I'm happy, as Chris said, that he is able to retire and hopefully enjoy many fruitful years of not working constantly at a corporation.
What do you do with yourself after 50 years of that?
I don't know. Probably like go on vacation.
Yeah. But then, I mean,
the first
a lot
time
of,
in two decades.
And a lot of people have ended up, you know, joining universities. And,
that's true.
And so I think that would be wonderful. Yeah.
And I mean, that way he's passing on his experience to a younger generation
I can see that
directly.
Happening.
That'd be great. So anyway, good luck, Mr. Takeda, et cetera, et cetera. Good luck, Nintendo. And Godspeed to all of us here at Retronauts. Anyway, I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. You can find Retronauts at Retronauts.com, on the iTunes Music Store, and on Podcast One's website and their app. You can also support us through Patreon, patreon.com/Retronauts. I think that's about it. Facebook, Twitter, yada, yada, yada. You know, the drill. Chris.
My Twitter handle is KobunHeat. That's KobunHeat. So come and tell me all the things I got wrong.
My Twitter handle is at Jose_Otero, and you can find me on IGN. And you can find Chris at Kotaku.
Kotaku.com.
There you go.
Yeah, plug it. Sure, plug why not?
I've never heard of this website.
Yeah.
Oh, hi, I'm Bob. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. My other podcast is Talking Simpsons, a chronological exploration of The Simpsons. Every week is a new episode. We're going in order. At the time of this recording, we're towards the end of season 5. Who knows what will be when this launches, but just go to TalkingSimpsons.com or find Talking Simpsons in your podcast machine or app device or Victrola or something. I don't know.
Do you guys release on wax cylinders?
We're going to. That's going to be awesome. A Patreon tier, so look out for that. Yeah. That's
exciting. Shake them Bart Simpsons like visage.
We got the Edison patent, so we're good.
Talking Simpsons by Thomas Edison.
And we're going to electrocute an elephant in every episode.
The entire thing just goes on. That's a bad idea.
All right. That is it for this episode. We'll be back on Monday with a full episode. Very exciting. Please look forward.